The Blaze Radio Network. On demand. Glenn Beck.
Free housing. Free college. Free college tuition, single-payer health care, doubling the welfare state, and minimum wage. Sound familiar? This is the same platform of any Democratic Socialist candidate here in the United States, whether it's Bernie Sanders, Ocasio-Cortez, and a whole fleet of new up-and-comers. But the platform, as familiar as it may sound, is actually the same platform as the Economic Freedom Fighters, or EFF, in South Africa. Now, this is a group of Marxist-Leninists who have now become the third largest political party in the country. Their leader has brought the EFF into the spotlight by tapping into populism. He fingered the white man as the answer to all of the problems, declaring at a rally back in January, "Go after a white man." Let me play the audio for you.
But we're starting with this whiteness. We're cutting the throat of whiteness. Whiteness, rekhawla mlala, go P equa, nga, fedile gayon.
He also, in that same speech, started to talk about, he just wants to know who these white people are. He wants to know what religion they are. He wants to know where they come from originally. He wants to know how long they've been here. And then they will cut the throats of whiteness. Any of this sound familiar? Because this is the kind of stuff that comes from democratic socialists, Marxists, Leninists. It always does. You have to have class or race warfare. This is why it's incredibly important that we do not give in to our outrage, that we break our addiction to outrage. Because if we don't, we will be led down this same path where the only answer is kill the other side. The EFF's numbers and popularity have grown so large now that they were actually able to force the African National Congress to begin seizing white-owned land, land owned by white farmers, and giving it to black South Africans. The policy has now begun. The new state law says that white farmers will be offered fair market value for their land by the government. If they turn it down, the land will be seized anyway. Fair market value for a land, piece of land that they have just seized included $1.37 million for a piece of land that is valued in the open market at $13.7 million. It's only a tenth of what the farms are worth. Obviously, a slap in the face. After turning it down, they received this letter. Notice is hereby given that a terrain inspection will be held on the farm at 10 a.m. in order to conduct an audit of the assets and a handover of the farm's keys to the state. This farm is just the first of many. This is exactly what happened with Lenin and Stalin. What they do is they blame the rich farmers. Then they kill or take the land away from the rich farmers. Then they give those farms to the people. The people don't have experience that the rich farmer has. They were rich for a reason. Then the country starves. A report earlier this month showed that 139 white-owned farms have been targeted now for seizure. So what happens if the farmers refuse to leave their land? These are the moments right before catastrophe. And it all began with a small group of Marxist and democratic socialists that were able to capture the national spotlight by harnessing hatred. We don't have land redistribution here yet, but the rise of democratic socialism and Marxism in South Africa should sound uncomfortably familiar. Look at what the new left is doing and saying here in America. They are categorizing each of us into groups and to identities and turning us one against the other. Social class against social class, race against race, gender against gender. Today's social justice is the undercover name for yesterday's bourgeoisie, proletariat workers' revolution. It is Marxism coming from the flank rather than straight ahead. You'll never hear this from a democratic socialist, but heed this warning. Marxism leads to violence every time. I ask you today to pray for the people of South Africa, both white and black. The whites that will be killed, the blacks that will have to live with it for the rest of their lives, and the children that will have to grow up now in chaos and violence. Pray for the people of South Africa, but also pray that we don't actually go over this cliff as we get precariously close to the edge.
It's Tuesday, August 21st. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
With a full understanding, with a full understanding of there are many things that I believe that I shall never say, but I shall never say the things that I do not believe. With the understanding of where the world is going and how easily it is to remove voices now for quote-unquote hate speech, I deliver this next segment with nothing but respect for other people's viewpoints. But in return, I demand that they respect my viewpoint. If we cannot come to a place to where we can say, well, we see the world radically differently, but you're still my neighbor. If we cannot come to that place, the only thing left is to silence one another. And when that doesn't work, to shoot. Remember, first you suggest, you nudge, then you shove, then you shoot. We are well into the shove category. I will shove your voice towards mine or out of the public square. There is new guidelines on that. They want to teach our children about safe sex. And as I read the guidelines, I thought to myself two things. One, the warning that I have told you over and over again from a woman named Paulina. She was one of the people that saved the Jews in Poland. She was about 90 when I met her. She had lived with this secret on what she had done and how many Jews she had saved. She started when she was about 16 years old in World War II. And when I met her, she was old and gray, but still as shy and quiet. She couldn't talk about it for a long time until the Iron Curtain came down, because that would have been wildly unpopular to be a Christian that saved Jews in the former Soviet Union. So it wasn't until the 1990s that she could tell her story, or people could tell her story for her, as she was very shy. I sat down with her with my family, and I asked her, I believe the tree of righteousness is in all of us. What do I do to water it? She said to me, you misunderstand. The righteous didn't suddenly become righteous. They just refused to go over the cliff with the rest of humanity. So as I read this today, I thought to myself, this is the cliff. This is one of them. And I will not go over the cliff with the rest of humanity, come what may. Here is the new LGBTQIA safe sex guide. Historically, when sex education was introduced to the general public, content was focused on puberty education for cisgender people, heterosexual sex, pregnancy prevention, and a reduction of STIs. During that time, there was a great deal of stigma and discrimination associated with being lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, intersex, or asexual. Gender-inclusive terms such as non-binary and trans had yet to enter the mainstream language and culture. This historic context and rampant homophobia and transphobia created a foundation where most sex education curricula didn't acknowledge the existence of LGBTQIA and non-binary individuals. Sex programs were instead developed based on an assumption that those receiving the information were solely heterosexual and cisgender. That's why that this safe sex guide is aimed at understanding the nuance, complex and diverse gender identities, sexual orientation, attractions and experiences that exist in the world, which vary across cultures and communities. We need an LGBTQIA inclusive safer sex guide because traditional guides are often structured in ways that presumes everyone's gender, female, male, non-binary, and trans. No. They presume everyone's gender is the same as the sex that they were assigned at birth. Male, female, or intersex, or differences in sexual development. Sex education resources often use videos and pictures and diagrams to portray important information, though these images and videos have historically failed to reflect and provide information about same-sex and queer relationships. These guides also often unnecessarily gender body parts as male parts or female parts and refer to sex with women or sex with men, including those who identify as non-binary. Many individuals don't see body parts as having a gender. People have a gender. As a result, the notion, excuse this clinical language, as a result, the notion that a penis is exclusively a male body part and a vulva is exclusively a female body part is inaccurate. By using the word parts to talk about genitals and using medical terms for anatomy without attaching gender to it, we become much more able to effectively discuss safe sex in a way that is clear and inclusive. For the purposes of this guide, we refer to the vagina as the front hole instead of using the medical term. This gender-inclusive language that's considerate of the fact that some trans people don't identify with the labels of the medical community. No. I am not teaching my children, nor will I ever comply to removing the medical term and teach my children about sex using the words front hole. I'm sorry. No. You want to do that? That is fine. But I will not comply. When we first started having this conversation about homosexuality, I am a libertarian. I was never against gay marriage. What I am against is forcing a church or a group of people to live within the standards someone else sets. So, if you want to get married, go get married. No skin off of my nose. But do not come to my church and tell me what I must believe or do. My faith is sacred to me, and it is just as much a part of me as anything else. I cannot change what I believe and still be me. Now, it's interesting because remember, you're teaching that gender is what you believe and you cannot change that. Well, then I would say my religious philosophy is the same. I wasn't born with it. It's what I believe. I will not tell you what to do, how to live, how to speak. Do not tell me what to do, how to act, what to say, how to think. You are not the boss of me, and I am not the boss of you. I happen to believe that all men are created equal, and we are endowed with certain inalienable rights. Dare I say, those rights that come from God, not from man. And those rights include life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I am not a hater for saying no. No. When we first started talking about acceptance of homosexuality, the case was made, and I believe this, that you're born this way. Many people, I believe, are absolutely born feeling differently. I believe it. There's no scientific proof of it, but I believe it. I've seen children. Children are born with their own personalities and their own, I don't know, their own thing. And no matter what, it's pretty hard to deny that natural thing that each of them come out with. They all have their own personality and their own style and their own thing. And every single homosexual person that I've ever known, loved, or just even met would not choose that lifestyle. Now that's changing. But let's not get so arrogant that we forget how horrible it was for a long time to live in the shadows. I know people who prayed every single day, God, please remove this from me. You are who you are, but so am I. There's much more to say about this in a minute. First, let me take a break. I have to thank our sponsor. It's the Palm Beach Letter. By the way, did you see the story today, Stu, about how Bitcoin is people in Turkey are dumping out of the lira now because there's a big devaluation that is happening with the Turkish lira. They're going to Bitcoin. There's a few countries that are starting to toy with this. Venezuela. If Venezuela would just say, we're going to Bitcoin, I think it would solve a lot of their problems. But, you know, we'll see. But now it's starting to happen in Turkey. Bitcoin and cryptocurrency expert Tika Tiwari from the Palm Beach Letter wrote about an announcement that would bring enormous amounts of money into Bitcoin. At the time, last year, it was trading at about $1,800. He said it could hit $10,000, and people thought he was nuts. It hit $20,000. We were in the middle of a horrible bear market at the time. Well, things are repeating itself. He's just announced, just like last year, another big event is happening, and he says it could take Bitcoin 10x or more by Christmas. Learn about cryptocurrencies, the best way to invest, what they are, why blockchain is a part of our future now. SmartCryptoCourse.com. Take that course now. SmartCryptoCourse.com or call 877-PBL-BECK. SmartCryptoCourse.com.
Glenn Beck.
You cannot mock truth isn't truth one day and then come out and say the opposite the next day, that there that the penis is not a male body part. Can't. Sorry. No. I will not go down your postmodernist wormhole.
Yeah, and you seem to feel a little uncomfortable saying terms like front hole.
Yeah.
So what do you think about frole and behole? Is that kind of like... Okay, let me...
No.
I wasn't going to go this far.
No, words have meaning.
So. How about fragina, freeness, and frubies?
I don't...
And then banus. That, I think, no. if you go the vagina, people will know what you mean, because they'll know what's... I guess you have to also determine what side of the body it's on for some reason. So, vagina, freenus, frubies, and banus. The new science.
No. No.
But, I mean...
No.
You sure you don't like any of the...
No.
Hey, guess what? You have hundreds of thousands of dollars on the line when you want to sell your house. I guess maybe the right way to go is just to look for someone maybe you have a light acquaintance with, who maybe, or maybe, you know what, even better, somebody whose face you saw on a bench. That's a great way to pick somebody who's going to represent you in a hundreds of thousands of dollars level of a transaction. Actually, maybe you should do something else. Maybe you should go to realestateagentsitrust.com. Realestateagentsitrust.com is the place to go when you want to sell your house fast and for the most money. Or if you're looking to buy, you want to find someone who you can trust, someone that knows what they're doing, someone who shares your values. Glenn started this company a while ago with the idea of there's got to be a better way. There's got to be a way to find a good real estate agent that can represent me in a transaction that I can trust, that can do a great job without all the hassle. RealEstateAgentsITrust.com is the result of that. Go there now and get the best real estate agent in your town. RealEstateAgentsITrust.com.
This is the Glenn Beck
Program.
All right,
Stu, we got a problem with vagina.
Really?
Yeah.
I think it's a great term.
No, it autocorrects to dragon.
Yeah.
Which I think she dragon. I think you could say she dragon, maybe. Maybe that's accurate. Maybe that is Google telling us, yes, vagina tells you the location front and what it is.
Yes.
I'm
just upset that these cisgender phones have not yet adopted the new appropriate language of vagina, freeness, frubies, and banus. At some point, we have to get over our old cisgender heteronormative ways.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you for finally
saying that. I'm going to clap for myself on that one. Wow, that was...
You are so righteous.
Thank you.
You know?
Yeah, I'm great. I'm really great. And I think I'm signaling to everyone the virtuous nature of
what I'm
doing.
I think you are.
And I think they understand it, and they feel it, and they give it back to me.
Really good.
Because I'm wonderful.
I think it's really good. Mm-hmm. Hey, by the way, speaking of virtue signaling, I'm having a hard time with the whole Asia Argento story because of Rose McGowan. Okay, so if you don't know, Asia Argento, she is a woman who was one of the big accusers of Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah, she is an actress, and she was, probably the most outspoken.
Mm-hmm.
Her and Rose McGowan were probably the two most outspoken about.
And Rose McGowan at the time tweeted, you know, you have to believe the women. You have to call out the abusers right away, and you have to distance yourself from them. Otherwise, you're just a bad human being. I'm trying to remember. Do we have the other tweet? Not the believe women, but the... Yeah, here it is. Believe survivors. Apologize for putting your career and wallet ahead of what was right. And grab your spine and denounce. If you do not do these things, you are still a moral coward. Okay, so that's Rose McGowan. Well, yesterday, Rose McGowan, after it was found out that her good friend, who is she using those tweets... to defend against, you know, Harvey Weinstein accusations, her friend was now accused of diddling an underage boy and you know, pretty much paying him off $380,000.
That's more than pretty much. That's a pretty good payday there, I would say. $380,000 is it's a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like you don't typically, I mean, this is what we heard every single time, that there was an accusation against the male. You don't pay someone $380,000 unless you've done something wrong. We certainly heard it about Donald Trump when he paid $140,000 to, Stormy Daniels.
Mm-hmm.
We heard that over and over again, that you don't pay someone $140,000 unless you've done something wrong.
Yeah. So now Rose McGowan has come out with a new tweet.
Mm.
And this new tweet is, none of us know the truth of the situation, and I'm sure more will be revealed. Be gentle. Wait a minute, Rose.
Did she just call herself a moral coward?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, were you not just telling us that you had to believe the survivor?
Yeah. It's interesting because when you have personal information about one of the two individuals involved in one of these situations, sometimes you judge it differently.
Huh.
Maybe the additional information you have causes you to pause and judge the situation not out of anger and moral outrage, but as factual information that you've received about a person
and
an individual.
And you know, hang on, it might also be that you don't even know the person, but you say, hey, there should be a process. We shouldn't just be a lynch mob.
Yeah. I mean, that should be your default position, in my view. It has not been the view of our society for the past year and a half.
Mm. But now that it's turning around on the actual hashtag MeToo founders, it is starting to be, well, wait, let's have some due process.
We saw this with Al Franken. Mm-hmm. We saw this with Lena Dunham had a situation like this where she was tweeting defense of someone accused.
Well, Al Franken is still being excused. I don't know if you heard Chelsea Handler. Chelsea Handler had...
I can almost always say no to a question like that.
Yeah. Well, here's what she has said now about Al Franken.
You mentioned the Me Too movement. When it comes to the Democratic Party, they have tried to purge, right, politicians who have faced allegations. I know you were a supporter of Al Franken in the past, and he hasn't ruled out running again. Should he?
I love Al Franken. So, yes, I would love for Al Franken to run again.
Really?
I think,
despite the,
yes,
I mean, there were like 8 allegations against him.
But have women putting their arm... I don't want to
Stop. No, they weren't about him putting his arm around. It wasn't the picture. It's what that woman said happened to her all during a comedy tour before that picture was taken. That was the last insult. Remember, he assaulted her backstage and forced himself on her and jammed his tongue down her throat.
Allegedly.
Mm-hmm. But we have to believe the accuser, don't we?
Well, you know what? No.
So there were 8 people that said this about Al Franken. All right, now go back to her.
If women putting their arm, I don't want to diminish anyone's legitimate claim of feeling like they've been assaulted, because that's your feeling.
Oh,
but I think there is a very big difference of a man putting his arm around you. He's a comedian. I've touched people's breasts and genitals. I can't imagine how many times in photos. That's just,
that doesn't excuse it,
but it's something, that's not a rape, that's not sexual assault, and it's not repeated behavior over and over again.
Okay, so wait a minute. So is she saying, because she's a comedian, because she's a celebrity, she can just grab people's genitals?
I don't know if she's saying you can do that, but she's saying she has done it.
She has done that. So she's not necessarily giving advice, but she is bragging about how many she may have grabbed in the past.
She is bragging about that, yes.
Okay. All right. I'm just trying to think if there's anything else that seems similar to that. But now it's totally okay. And did you notice she also said, I don't want to dismiss anyone's legitimate claim.
Legitimate? Is that legitimate rape? I remember when that used to sink politicians, and we'd never hear from them ever again.
But she didn't say legitimate claim of assault. She said legitimate claim of feeling as though you were assaulted.
Yes.
Because that's just feelings. No, see, this is the problem with postmodernism. As Ben Shapiro says, facts don't care about your feelings. It's a fact. You were either assaulted or you were not assaulted. You can feel that you were assaulted all you want, but that's really a problem with you, and I'm not going to delve into your sickness. I am not going to verify and condone and coddle your illegitimate feelings of being assaulted if the assault didn't happen.
The same way we don't coddle someone who did assault someone who doesn't feel like they did anything wrong.
Correct.
You don't. It's about what happened, not about how they feel about it.
It's the facts, not the feeling.
And, you know, look, I think she's actually right in the aspect of there is a major difference between Chelsea Handler jokingly grabbing somebody in a photo and somebody who is actually assaulted, like from Harvey Weinstein. There is a line there. That doesn't mean that either one is a good idea, But there's clearly a difference.
Do you know anybody in your life? I mean, we know comedians. Do you know anybody in your life that can legitimately say, I can't even count the number of people I've grabbed by the genitals in a photograph?
I happened to be watching an Office episode the other day. And in the Office episode, Dwight and Pam are trying to decipher whether Jim is attracted to the new office worker. And in this debate where they're trying to figure it out, Dwight takes on the task of trying to assess after they're together.
I got it.
And he fakes falling down and he grabs for something. And I mean, he grabs Jim's, his freeness several times.
That's on a TV show.
Right. I know.
She's saying in photographs.
Right. Right. So what my point, though, is that if it's a, you know, it would be ridiculous, obviously. And if someone didn't want it to happen or didn't think it was funny, it would be obviously very bad.
Sure.
However, I wouldn't justify what she's doing there. However, I can see, you know, she's known for sexual comedy. I think guys, generally speaking, don't really care. I don't know that that's ever happened to me, but if it did, it wouldn't really bother.
Our genitals?
Right, like, you'd be what the hell? Get off me.
She said breasts. Right. Our genitals, are those exclusively male, you cisgender white pig?
I'm just saying that I'm trying to come up with a circumstance. My point, however, is more, I guess, targeted at the idea that there is a difference. Right. There's no way, there's no story I can tell you in which a justified end of like, oh, and then he took off his bathrobe and forced her into the shower. There's not a scenario. Mm-hmm. So there is a difference. And we've pointed this out many times on the show that there is a major difference between what Al Franken did and what Harvey Weinstein did. And they shouldn't be lumped exact same thing. I'm talking about the photo part.
Photo part with Al Franken is not the part that personally disturbs me. Mm-hmm. It is what happened leading up to the photo.
Yeah. And you know,
that's assault.
I mean, there's been a wide range of this. There's a spectrum. We now like understand kind of the idea of the spectrum from, you know, different, you know, medical situations. And there's a spectrum here. That doesn't mean that any of it's good. But I mean, when you're talking about like Louis C.K. is much different than Harvey Weinstein. Glenn Thrush, who was one of the reporters, was much different than anything that we saw from, the worst of the worst. And like the idea that all of those are lumped in under this thing, Me Too, is a problem, I think, that society has not figured out how to deal with yet. And so there's an element there where you could say, OK, well, what she's saying has some merit. However, Chelsea Handler is not a fair arbiter, and she's just defending this person because she likes him. Mm-hmm. I think we all recognize that the reason she's coming up with these wonderful excuses on these things is because she likes Al Franken, and if it was a conservative doing the exact same thing, she'd be on Twitter saying how horrible they were, and they are all mass rapists, and they should all go to prison. And that's the problem.
Well, she may know Al Franken. There's a difference. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've had several conversations with Bill O'Reilly. It's not that I know Bill O'Reilly. I know other people as well, and I don't defend them. You know, it's not that you know them or that I agree with their politics. I think in the worst case scenario, it is.
Yeah, I mean, like, even, I mean, you talked about Roger Ailes many times, and I don't think I've heard you put up a defense of Roger.
Nope.
Even though you knew him very well. Where, you know, Bill, you've known fairly well as well over the years. And, you know, again, when you are involved in a situation where someone has been accused of something terrible, someone you know well, you should insert your personal knowledge of that person into your analysis of the situation. That does not mean they get a free pass for anything they've done.
Without dismissing facts.
Absolutely.
That's not my feelings that steer me and say, I don't believe that about Bill. Mm-hmm. It's the fact that we've traveled with him and been around him for a long time, and none of us ever saw anything like this, ever, and can't even imagine it. Doesn't mean it's not true. Didn't happen. But I don't know that, and I'm not going to judge him.
Exactly. And everybody knows. I mean, you know, The Office is a good example. The, you know, Packer, who comes in all the time and is like talking about how he's having sex with all these women on the road, and he's always groping people and making inappropriate jokes. Everybody knows a guy like that. And if they got accused of something, you'd say, that does not surprise me at all.
I mean, that like, is Donald Trump. Come on. Well, are you really? Is anybody surprised by Stormy Daniels? Okay, it did happen, didn't happen. I don't know, but it wouldn't be surprising if it did. Because we know his character and what he's all about.
He's had he was famous for his sort of womanizing ways and talked about it on Howard Stern openly. Yeah. But that's different than, you know, if you had heard someone talking like Trump talked on the bus constantly, you would think, okay, this person is might be doing these things.
Yes.
However, that's, you know, not necessarily the way he's always talking.
All right. Okay, so let me tell you about our sponsor this half hour. It's Casper Mattress. Middle of the night, you're tossing and turning. You're not sleeping. You're drenched in sweat. You could, you know, turn up the AC or you can have a fan on you. But why don't you get rid of your heat-trapping mattress? Sleep cool and comfortable on a Casper mattress. All Casper mattresses use premium foams that relieve pressure and help align your body so you fall asleep feeling comfortable and waking up feeling refreshed. Breathable material. That means you're guaranteed to sleep cool all summer long. It ships in a free box so small you're not going to believe it actually has a mattress in there. It makes it easy for you to get the mattress from your front door to your bedroom. And you can try it now risk-free for 100 nights. If you don't love it, they're going to come and they'll pick up the mattress and refund everything. No questions asked. So sleep cool and comfortable every night. Get a Casper. Try it for free for 100 nights. Free shipping, free returns. Now, go to Casper.com and use the promo code BECK. $50 off the purchase of your select mattress so you can begin trying it out. Casper.com, promo code BECK. Casper.com, terms and conditions do apply. We have some new suggestions for new terms for body parts.
You had a problem with Froll?
Well, I had a problem with Froll because it autocorrects to dragon, which doesn't work. That would be front hole.
Right, Froll, we shortened that to Froll or behole.
Yeah, but Froll doesn't work because I also have my mouth and my, you know, my nose holes and my ocular cavities.
So we've been going with frouth.
Frouth?
For mouth. Vagina, freenus, frubies, pretty acceptable.
Right.
The banus is something that people are talking about. We've also been hearing from people at World of Stew for their terms that they want to implement here. And the Froveries.
Froveries.
Have been, I think, acceptable. And Frestacles is one, I think.
Okay, Froveries. Froveries aren't in the front. They're inside.
Look, I'm not a doctor here.
Well,
I'm
just it doesn't take a doctor.
Where do you feel they are? That's, I think, the more important question. Not where they are, but where do you feel they are?
I feel that they're in the refrigerator in the little egg, plastic egg thing.
Oh, fridge. For ovaries works perfectly then.
Okay, good. Ovaries in the fridge. I like that. Okay, good.
There you go.
All right. Another problem solved. Welcome to Postmodernism 101 on the Glenn Beck Program.
Glenn Beck.
Washington Times published an interesting op-ed a few days ago. It's a list of conditions, criteria, that in author L. Todd Wood's words would be used to destroy society. He said, quote, if I want to destroy an enemy society and I had a long term focus, I wanted to do it, you know, stealth and effectively, I would make the society destroy itself and I'd take away the ability for it to defend itself. So I would do the following. Step one, I would destroy the religious ideals that brought the country together and held it together, allowing it to thrive and be exceptional. In short, I would destroy, in the West, Christianity. Two, I would destroy the family, the fabric of society. I would tear apart the nuclear family that produced stable children, future contributors to the nation's wealth and power. A society that does not reproduce is a dying society. Three, I would promote the concept of toxic masculinity and extremist feminism. What better way to make a society less masculine, less able to field a strong military? In short, I would feminize the male population, making it less effective in battle. Four, I would destroy the education system. I'd plant Marxist professors throughout the university system, teaching new generations nothing about American history, but filling their heads full of communist nonsense, and propaganda. They would know nothing of Washington, Lincoln, or Jefferson, but they would know of Malcolm X and Lenin. 5, I would divide the races. What better way and what better method of dividing and conquering than to foster a race war, filling minorities' heads full of lies of police brutality and developing a culture of hate towards law enforcement. 6, I would corrupt the federal government. I'd fill the intelligence and security services with traitors to the nation's founding. When any political figure arose that threatened my diabolical agenda, I would use these corrupt agencies to target and frame any rising star who loved America, even if he was a duly elected president of the United States. 7, I would take away the population's means to defend itself, meaning I would take away their guns. The fear of an armed population would stop any invasion. I'd have to get rid of this problem. 8, I would destroy self-reliance and ingenuity by making over half of the population dependent on the government, unable to take care of themselves. 9, I would use big tech to completely remove any viewpoint or ideas that were associated with the old America. I would ban them from the internet. Heck, I'd take over the internet. I'd work with tyrannical powers all over the world to develop internet censorship to eventually prevent any opposing views to be heard by anyone. 10, I would corrupt the nation's leadership with money, finding those who would sell out their country for pieces of silver. I'd make sure that they were strategically placed in powerful positions on all sides. I'd shell out money through the legislature to make sure no laws were passed to oppose my agenda. 11, I would promote the disrespect of the nation's symbols. Yes, I would have people kneel during the national anthem. I would burn the flag, tear down statues of the nation's history. I would make sure people hate the very fabric of the nation that gave them such wealth and power. 12, I would find a straw man or a straw country who was also a malicious adversary to America, though much less powerful, and I would focus all the negative energy and recriminations towards this straw man country. In this manner, the targeted nation would be ignorant of my true intentions. He warns in his article, everything I've just written is happening right now in front of our eyes. It is difficult to disagree with him.
It's Tuesday, August 21st. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
My new book, Addicted to Outrage, comes out here in the next couple of weeks. September 18th is when it's available in stores. I ask you to go to Amazon and pick up a copy. It is not just a look at what's happening today. Some of it is very, very funny. Some of it is pretty terrifying. It's a look at today, tomorrow, and our history. And it asks in the middle of it 5 important questions that we have to ask ourselves as a nation. If we want to save the Western society, is it worth saving? Are we good or are we bad? I use the example in the book of Winston Churchill. I'm a huge Churchill fan. But if you were from India, Churchill was a monster. So which is he? Is he good or bad? Arthur Herman is the author of Gandhi and Churchill, a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. But he's also the author of one of my favorite books, Freedom's Forge. It came out a few years ago. And I've wanted to have him on the show for quite some time. But he's here with us today. Arthur, welcome to the program. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing very well. It's a pleasure to be on. Hey, are you going to send me a copy of your new book?
Yes, I will. If you'd send me a copy of you know, Freedom's Forge signed, I would cherish
delighted.
It.
Delighted to do that.
Yeah, Freedom's Forge, and we'll get into it a little while. Freedom's sure. Forge is just a tremendous, tremendous history book that I think everybody should have.
I appreciate that.
Let me go back to Churchill and Gandhi.
Sure.
If you are from, you know, India, you see Gandhi completely different, not Gandhi, Churchill, completely differently than those in the West do. So,
yeah, I think that's probably true, especially today. I would say less so during the wartime period, when you saw that there was a lot of respect, including by Gandhi, for Churchill, for his defiant stand against the Nazis and his ability to really rally Britain, which a lot of Indians thought, hey, you know, Britain, it's on the decline. It's losing its credibility around the world. It's an imperialist power. And they were, I think, quite shocked and surprised with the way in which Churchill was able to rally the British people and then basically rally the free world to fight against Nazism. But you're right. Today, a lot of the focus is on Churchill, you know, as a white supremacist, as supposedly the guy who triggered the Great Bengal Famine during the course of the war in 43,
44. You don't think so?
No, I don't think so at all. I think what you come to realize about the Great Bengal Famine is it was a concatenation of bad circumstances, the loss of Burma, which had been India's main source for rice imports, and a lot of mishandling on the ground by the British bureaucracy. The civil service bureaucracy basically failed to deal with the problem that for 30 years they had been assuring Indians they could deal with. I mean, it's big government in action, Glenn, and they failed utterly until Churchill appointed Archibald Wavell as viceroy, and he managed to turn the situation around with Churchill's encouragement. So, you know, Churchill, if I may speak on this subject, you know, people talk about the similarities between Churchill and Donald Trump. And I don't think sometimes that's a bit overblown, but mm-hmm. Churchill had his own version of tweets, which was his outbursts, especially in front of the War Council, in which he would denounce India for bothering him about the food shipments and about the need to divert food supplies to India when they were needed for the armed forces. And he was capable of saying some quite shocking things. And so just as people focus on Trump's Twitter feed and think that that's a clue to understanding his mind and his policies, there's been a tendency to look at Churchill's kind of irritated outbursts. He had a lot in his mind in 1943. You know?
Yeah, a little bit.
A little bit.
Yeah, a little
and,
bit.
And having to deal with a crisis far, far away in a country which was already plunged into chaos because of civil disobedience, strained his patience. And so he said things, let off steam, that historians today, particularly certain Indian historians, capitalize on as a way to promote the idea that that Churchill was somehow either responsible for or even the architect of the Great Bengal Famine. It was a terrible famine. What, 1.5 million people died?
So,
but Churchill's responsibility for this shrinks away when you look at what the real situation was and understand it in the course of the history of India under British rule.
Talking to one of my favorite authors and historians, senior fellow of the Hudson Institute, Arthur Herman, author of Freedom's Forge, also Gandhi and Churchill. Wouldn't you say that all great men are both good and bad when you look back through the eyes of today's history, that there is no perfect man? Gandhi was a racist as well. He didn't see the plight of the Africans, which was very similar to his own in India. He didn't want to be seated on the same train car with an African.
Yes, or as the derogatory term of the day, the equivalent of N-word for us, kafirs. And Gandhi was fairly contemptuous of the
right.
of the blacks in South Africa.
But that doesn't
there.
That
and
doesn't
explain in the book. And it explained in the book he began his civil disobedience campaigns in South Africa to call attention to the plight of Indians living there, who he believed, I think correctly, should be treated with the same rights as any other British subjects. But his big complaint was that they had been relegated on the other side of the color line, away from white inhabitants and citizens in South Africa, but been relegated to the same side as South Africa's blacks. He wanted Indians pushed to the correct side, the upper side.
Right. With nothing to say about the blacks.
Very little to say about that. It was not his concern. And it was not an issue that that really motivated his multiple visits to with the British with regard to Indian presence in Africa generally. He was a nationalist. I mean, and this is one of the things that I think both he and, as I explain in the book, both he and Churchill were both very strong nationalists. And Gandhi has come to be given a kind of this universalist, globalist kind of agenda because of his pacifism and his belief in passive resistance. But he was an Indian nationalist from beginning to end. So, and that's what drove him, and that's what that was his legacy.
So do you walk away feeling the same way about Gandhi and Churchill, that you could just concentrate? What I'm driving towards is we're asking now if America is a good place or a bad place. It's both. It's both. It's what are we getting better or are we getting worse? I think we're getting better in the long term. We're getting much better as a people. But we've done horrible things. We've done really amazing, great things. We're neither bad nor good. We're both.
And that's what a proper study of history should bring, Glenn, and also of the study of historical figures. I think you're absolutely on the mark here. And, you know, and I've written about look at my record of biographies, the Gandhi and Churchill book, my book on Douglas MacArthur, reaching back almost 20 years, my book on Joseph McCarthy. You know, I did a book on McCarthy, and what I explained in there was that there was a lot of bad about McCarthy. There was a lot of good, too. He was on to a real issue, namely the communist conspiracy to subvert the U.S. government. And the way in which it had infiltrated into the federal government in the 1930s and 1940s. But people were outraged because in many cases people want, you know,
a villain.
They want saints and villains.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to do. It's really hard with a handful of characters in history. I think you know who they are.
Yeah.
It's really hard to find ones in democratic Western societies who fit either one of those bills.
So let me break here, and then I want to pick it up because I think McCarthy is a really great example. I first started reading about McCarthy and realizing, wait a minute, he's not this you know, black cloaked Darth Vader, you know, villain every step of the way. He really did have some things right. But if we can't recognize that nuance, because we're now in a society where you're either 100% in the boat or on the train, or you're 100% off the train. And that's not where a healthy society should be. We'll pick it up there when we come back. Arthur Herman, you must read his work, especially start with Freedom's Forge. It's just remarkable. We'll talk about it here in just a second. Let me tell you about our sponsor this half hour. It's Goldline. Goldline's new Silver Maple Flex is a bar that is great. Made by the Canadian Mint, it allows you to break off smaller pieces for barter and trade. It's about the size of a credit card, and you can just snap it apart like that. And now you have, instead of, you know, a credit card size bar of silver, you have little teeny pieces of silver, and it comes in, what is this? This is a 1/4 ounce. It comes in 1/10, 1/20 ounces. And so you can use this to barter, because if things ever get really bad, I mean, God help us. But remember, yesterday we were talking to that woman from Venezuela who said, I just want to remind you, Venezuela was like America, and we went nuts. And look at us now, and they are starving to death now.
Well, that could never happen here, luckily, Glenn.
Yeah, luckily it'll never happen.
Never will happen.
All done by the Royal Canadian Mint. I want you to check it out. Call Goldline, see if it's right for you. Else can be held in your IRA for precious metals. It's goldline.com. Call them now. Goldline.com. 1-866-GOLDLINE. 1-866-GOLDLINE or goldline.com. Author, historian, senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, Arthur Herman is joining us. He's written several books. You need to read them all. Freedom's Forge, Gandhi and Churchill are two that I can't recommend highly enough. Arthur, can you draw parallels between today and the Red Scare? Are we facing a new form of McCarthyism, except it's now the hunt for those who will not abide with postmodernism?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth to that. And what we come to realize is when you really study the history of intellectuals, right? And that'd be an interesting book, wouldn't it? Sort of
yeah.
Intellectuals through history, particularly in the modern age. And what you come to realize is that contrary to the their own self-image, they don't tend to be really supporters of liberty and freedom. You look at the role that, for example, German academics played during the Nazi period,
mm-hmm.
when they basically closed ranks with the government, expelled their Jewish colleagues, and signed petitions lining up in support of the Third Reich. During the 1930s, you had a similar groupthink on the far left, supporting communist and fellow traveler organizations, signing petitions, which got them into trouble in the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the 1950s, when there were attacks on dissent and scrutiny from government about the curricula that was being used in classes in sociology and in the social sciences generally and literature, the universities, with a few exceptions, basically went along with the attacks. When Bertrand Russell, for example, the British philosopher, was denied entry into the country because of his atheism. There were some academics who stood up for his right to speak, even if they disagreed, like Sidney Hook, and there were others who did not, many others who didn't. And I think what we're seeing right now is that the radicalization, the long march through the institutions, remember that line from the 1960s,
mm-hmm.
has really come into its own in the American Academy, in the humanities, in the liberal arts, and in the social sciences. And what they've done is to create a kind of, I'm going to use this term, intellectual gulag, in the sense that if you don't adhere to the party line, if you or even waver from it or express doubt about the wisdom of having such a party line, then punishment is meted out to you, not beatings and attacks, unless, of course, you're Charles Murray. But with being silenced and being denied tenure and coming under attack. The difference, of course, Glenn, and the irony is that this is all being done not as a result of government pressure being put to bear on institutions, as was the case, you know, with the universities in Nazi Germany or universities during the so-called Red Scare. This is pressure coming from within. From administrators and radicals.
If you look at Nazi Germany, though, a lot of that was internal pressure as well, not just from the government. I mean, especially when it comes to science, the doctors
right.
and the nurses
right.
were.
That's right. Which I've written about, as you know, written about in my Idea of Decline book about the influence of race science and eugenics, all done, of course, in the interest of a progressive
progress, yeah,
progress,
okay.
and progressive ideologies, including socialism, but with horrendous effects later on.
We continue our conversation in just a moment with Arthur Herman, author and historian. Continues in a minute. Stand by.
You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program.
Historian and just fantastic, fantastic author, Arthur Herman, is with us. He's a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute. He has written The Idea of Decline in the West, MacArthur, 1917. I mean, it's about Wilson. You had me at hello. And... one of my favorite books, Freedom's Forge. Welcome back to the program.
It's a pleasure.
So let's talk a little bit about the cycle of American history and where do you think we are, Arthur? Have we been here before, and do we survive?
Okay, that's right. Put your historian on the spot.
Yes,
and make him pull out his crystal ball.
That's right.
Well, I will tell you, I share a great optimism about where the American experiment is headed long term. I think we're in a very unhealthy place right now. But these have happened in American history. You know, we had a moment like this in 1860. By the way, that is not to say that I think we're on the verge of a 1860, 1861 type of national catastrophe. But I think that the aspect of division that's taken place here, a division which really is going to be very difficult for us to resolve with kind of the normal politics and the way in which these issues have been resolved in the past. You know, we had terrible divisions during the McCarthy period. You know, people were routinely accusing Truman and his band of advisors of being traitors, of being basically the tools of Moscow. We had terrible divisions. You remember them in 1968, you know. I was a kid. I was thoroughly radicalized, tried to convince my parents that I needed to go to the Chicago Convention. They said, you're 11 years old. I don't think you're going to go to the Chicago Convention on your own. But I watched, you know, I watched the convention, watched the riots, the coverage, the riots of the media there. Abraham Ribicoff telling, you know, Richard Daley that his police were using Gestapo tactics on the streets of Chicago. I saw all that live.
But there was we hadn't lost the entire university system. We hadn't had our children indoctrinated into this postmodernist stuff that is absolute poison.
It is, and I think also we didn't have the kind of social media. Everybody trashes social media. I think social media, in the end, has been a tremendous benefit, and I think it will be a very powerful and constructive tool. But what has happened in the short term, and this is what happened with the printing press, you know, in the 16th century, is that it's become a means by which every kook and every angry person now is able to express themselves in more and more violent and more extreme terms. And I think what we've reached is a kind of cycle of verbal violence in our media, not just the social media, but the mainstream media. Turn on CNN and look and see what happens there, or MSNBC. And I think we have a president right now who, unlike other politicians, doesn't try to avoid conflict. And veers towards compromise at every turn. He seeks out conflict. And I think that's one of the reasons why he was sent to Washington by the voters, was that they said, look, you're going to be our bull in the china shop because there's a lot of crockery there that badly needs breaking. And we're watching the breakage and the reaction of those whose livelihoods, whose careers, whose worldviews were built on that old decaying Washington establishment. And I think there's going to be a fight to the finish here, Glenn.
So
I don't think that Trump won't quit. I don't think Mueller and the political establishment are going to quit. I think they're too committed into this. And it's going to be a fight as to which to the end, when which one edifice or the other collapses. I think the Washington establishment is the one that's going to be the loser in all this. And I think that we are going to come out a lot stronger with a renewal of the American experiment as a result of it, but it's going to be an ugly process.
So how do you, when you have people now on both sides that are so angry, so they feel like they've been squashed, not listened to, the other side isn't listening, so why should I listen to you? You know, there's such distrust. I mean, right now, you know, I think the average Democrat feels very much like I do. They're tired of all of this stuff. They just want more welfare. That doesn't make them a communist or a socialist. They just want bigger state programs. And the same with the right. They feel like there is a loss of their culture and their heritage, which does not make them a Nazi or an identitarian. It makes them a concerned citizen about, hey, my culture is important too. And so we're taking those real things and pushing them off and making them nonsense to the other side, and that's not allowing us to address the real feelings of real actual people.
No, it's not. And it leads to that sense of division, which feels more or less permanent, which I don't think is the case, but it's been heightened by the way in which the media now has become a means by which to whip up this kind of frenzy and this kind of hysteria, social media included, of course. But I think the worries on both sides are very real. You know, you look at the 20-somethings, right, who have signed on to socialism, their minds having been infected with the idea that socialism, even communism, is a viable alternative to capitalism or even a superior alternative to capitalism, because they don't know the history, they don't know the reality of countries like Cuba, Venezuela, Cambodia in the past, and the Soviet Union in the Cold War days under Lenin and Stalin and others. But what drives them is a deep anxiety about where their future lies. You know, when you have an entire generation, Glenn, who are saddled with, you know, five-figure student debt coming out of school, and who have that millstone around their necks which they can't escape, and in which their earning power in real terms is reduced in order to serve that, who have a feeling that the degrees to which they were convinced by their advisors and by universities that they needed to get in conflict resolution or sociology or international relations is actually not going to get them very far or anywhere to solve the problems of where they want to go in the life that they want. They're going to look to government to solve that problem. And then you look at the people who supported Trump and who still do, in the sense that they were abandoned. Trump calls them the forgotten man, right? Borrowing a term from our friend Amity Schles. Mm-hmm. That the forgotten man of the 1930s is now the forgotten communities in America's heartland in the 1990s and the 2000s. And for them, what they see is, just as you were saying, is an America that they grew up with, America whose promise was part of the way in which those communities lived together and were able to find solidarity, being pulled apart, being denigrated, being attacked from the opening moments of an NFL game to the way in which immigrants and illegal immigrants from stream across the border and are considered by one political party as more their lives more valuable and their welfare more important than those of their fellow Americans. And you are definitely setting up a situation, a formula for some really serious social and political conflict, and that's kind of where we're stuck right now. But this is where we are now.
You know better than most, the one thing we haven't injected into this is real fear, like a war. I mean, you know, you wonder how anyone could believe that aliens were attacking, you know, when Orson Welles did War of the Worlds. It wasn't just that the medium was new. They were used to hearing all about this foreign enemy that was going to be invading, and the fear lived. They were living it daily. Plus, you add into that any kind of economic collapse. We don't have the infrastructure anymore. I mean, the personal infrastructure anymore to be the people that we were, that our grandparents were.
No, we face some enormous challenges, Glenn. And I've been talking about this. You know, The Freedom's Forge is a book which is now really beginning to grab the attention of policymakers at the Pentagon.
It's fantastic.
And elsewhere. And 2 weeks ago, in fact, I was at a meeting at the National Defense University organized by the Pentagon's Office of Net Assessment, which is the one that looks, that's the office that looks ahead, what's coming up on the horizon. And the discussion was, would the United States be able to mobilize in the event of a protracted conflict with a near-peer competitor? And they brought me there to talk about it. Freedom's Forge has become very much sort of one of the key texts for discussing these issues about mobilization at the Pentagon, also at the White House. And it's very gratifying to see that happen and know that your words can have an impact, you know, on where policy is going. But what I stressed to them is, I said, look, from the point of view of mobilization, we've got two issues. One is on the technical and industrial side. And there's a host of reasons why this is going to become a challenge. You know, our traditional defense industrial base has decayed. There's no doubt about that. We're going to have to look. In World War II, we had the industrial base that was necessary and sufficient to mobilize. Today, we're going to have a global supply chain and look to our allies to help. That with the new technologies that underpin weapon systems of the future, AI and quantum technology and 3D printing and robotics, that we're going to have, this is a whole different way of thinking about what an industrial base is. We'll have to look at commercial companies. But Glenn, the other thing that I stressed to them was the real obstacle we're going to face is not in the industrial economic area, it's in the cultural area. In World War II, when Bill Knudsen, as I described in my book, went to meet his fellow colleagues in the auto industry and their suppliers and said, we need you to help build planes, to build parts for planes, to build tanks. They said, Bill, we'll do it. Our country calls and we'll answer. I don't think we have that kind of response from our leading industrial and economic powers today, especially in Silicon Valley. If you look at what Google did with 3,000 employees protesting the Google's contract to work with the Pentagon on Project Maven and saying, we don't want to go in that way. And then on the other side, you've got Google building in China,
yes,
an AI research center, hiring Chinese research scientists who are going to be developing AI they're going to be using for their military. We have a problem.
Arthur, I have to tell you something. You're going to love my new book. You and I should be best friends. I don't know why you are concerned with exactly the same things I'm concerned about. I know this has taken a long time for some reason. Maybe it's our fault of getting you on the air. But I would love to, I'd love to invite you back just to talk about Freedom's Forge. And if we could do that soon, that'd be great if you have time. And I'd also like
to do that.
I'd like to bring you down and just spend a few hours with you on air, because your voice needs to be heard. You have the history to back it up. And we are facing things. I mean, when you start talking about future wars and tech in Silicon Valley, you are right on the money. I don't know what to do about it. So,
well, I think we should really talk about this and get your audience involved with this too, because we are facing a high tech STEM crisis, you know, science, technology, engineering, and math crisis that is really going to affect how we're able to handle national security issues in the next decade.
Okay. Arthur,
and this is something that needs to be addressed now.
Let's,
the Pentagon is getting its mind around it, but we need to get the American public behind it.
I've been talking about a Manhattan Project for this very thing. We'll hang on the phone. I want to get some information from you, and let's book you to spend some more time with us. Arthur Herman, the Hudson Institute, author and historian. Read Freedom's Forge. It's fantastic. Read it.
Nice. Get a room.
He's awesome.
Yeah. Man. I mean, it's like...
He knows everything.
Yeah. Mm. It's like talking to a smart me.
I have no experience with that. That's so weird.
Yeah, I know. Well, you just heard it. He's a smart me. He's got the facts, right. You know. All right. Anyway, SimpliSafe Home Security. Great security system. Fantastic protection. Really easy to use. There are no contracts. There are no wires. Now, if you're still using, you know, a hardwired security system in your house... You know, good luck with that. That's, you know, it's cute and everything.
Yeah, I mean...
For a while, you know, my grandmother had one of those washers that had the rollers on top, too. You know?
Yeah.
She had one of those.
And then maybe you would advance from that. You graduate.
Yeah. You know, grandma was like, well, I'm comfortable with... Don't get your fingers near it. It'll squash your hands. Okay. Well, grandma, they do have washing machines now where all that's enclosed. But she wasn't ready for that yet. And maybe you're not ready for, you know, actually state-of-the-art technology to protect your home and family. SimpliSafe, comprehensive protection for your home, for your office, for your store, whatever you have that you need protecting. Round the clock, home security for fire and police. They'll dispatch whatever you need. SimpliSafe works during power outages, down Wi-Fi, even if somebody comes in and tries to smash your keypad. It is intuitive. It is easy. It's almost invisible. There's no wires and no contracts. $14.99 a month. That's just for the monitoring. Cancel it anytime. There's no contract. And you own the system. Check it out now. SimpliSafeBeck.com. That's SimpliSafeBeck.com. Welcome to the program. I feel like I have a new friend. It's nice.
Yeah, someone who likes you and seemingly would actually admit it, which is rare.
Which is very rare.
I mean, even from people that you work with, who've worked
right.
with for 20 years.
I don't know.
Those people won't admit it, those individuals.
Who are you speaking about? I mean, 20 years, that's pretty specific.
Sure, yeah, it's been 20 years this year.
Yeah.
20 years lost when you really think about it. 20 years down the drain.
Really has been the lost 20 years, hasn't it?
Yeah, half my life down the drain and gone forever.
Yep, yep. And the good news is you'll just keep taking it. We have a really, we have an amazing story to tell you coming up next. Just hero story after hero story after hero story. You're going to love it. It's coming next.
Glenn Beck. It's Tuesday, August 21st. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
My hands shook in terror as a barrage of sniper and military gun rounds pinged off the friendly Iraqi army tank, our only refuge, and slammed in the ground around us. The tank's exhaust singed the hair on our hands and our arms as we screamed for the little girl. Crawl to us. To all, come here, we shouted over the roar of the ISIS bullets and airbursts from friendly artillery smokescreen. We were less than 20 feet from her, but we might as well have been on another planet. The tank fired its main guns, blowing a hole in the former hospital from which we were taking most of the gunfire. Boom! The sound was deafening, replacing the battle's cacophony with painful ringing in my ears, but the little girl didn't even blink. She's in shock. Somehow she had survived the massacre when ISIS had opened fire on civilians fleeing the city. It was almost 2 days ago, and now in a pile of rotting corpses, she huddled next to her dead mother's body, suffering an even more cruel demise under the relentless desert sun. No doubt ISIS had left her as bait, and we had taken it. But we were her only chance. "I'm going to get the girl," I called to David, our team leader. "No, no, 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 no," he grabbed my arm. "There's not enough smoke." In spite of the adrenaline coursing through my body, it only took me a fraction of a second to know he was right. I would have been shot to pieces. David, who's borderline fearless, had seen a lot more combat and knew what he was doing. I decided just to shut up and let him give the orders. He pulled out his cell phone and called the U.S. military commander stationed several miles away. "We need more smoke," he yelled over the noise and shoved the phone back into his pocket. "Get ready to give me some covering fire when the smoke comes in." "Copy that," I turned to Sky, a former Marine and a team member who, like the rest of us, had volunteered for this suicidal rescue mission. We'd all seen the aftermath of ISIS massacres, whole families, babies even, slaughtered in the streets. "You go inboard, I'll go outboard," I said, meaning that Sky would take one step out from behind the tank to shoot and I would take three so that we'd avoid each other's field of fire. "Roger," Sky nodded. Since the assault on West Mosul exactly 30 days ago, our team had been through a lot, but we knew how to work together. Seconds later, a round of smoke hit right on the target, sending 100 balls of fire harmlessly into the middle of the war-torn and body-strewn Mosul highway. Beside the Iraqi tank, the only support we had left, like the rest of the battles to retake the city, the fiercest urban conflict since World War II, this was an Iraqi ground forces operation. We had only volunteered to help. There was no cavalry to call in. It was just us, a few AK-47s, the tank, and some smoke. "Okay, guys, wait for it." David grabbed my shirt and glanced around the tank. Suddenly, he sprinted off to get the little girl. Sky and I jumped from behind the tank and started dumping rounds into the ISIS-held hospital, which was still visible through the smoke. My ancient AK-47, a subpar weapon at best, and not what you'd expect a former Navy SEAL to carry in a showdown, was full of tracer rounds as I watched each of the bullets streaking through the clouds of smoke and arched into the dark windows of the hospital. Whoever was firing from that position only moments ago was now taking cover. But there were dozens of other windows we weren't hitting. If a sniper had me in his sights, I was toast. We all were. As a member of the Free Burma Rangers, I'd been preparing myself to be okay with death. Because this rescue, this battle, and most importantly, these people were worth it. But in order to understand that, you must first understand where I come from and how I came to this moment. Ephraim Mateos. That is the city of death. It's a new book coming out, Humanitarian Warriors in the Battle of Mosul. Ephraim is joining us now.
Thank you for having me on.
I saw you in that battle. The world saw you in that battle. You were shot in the leg right after that in a video that I don't even know how many millions of downloads it has now.
Yeah, there's probably 100 million views out there just from the different sources. Yeah.
And you, everybody remembers it. You, the three of you, were standing behind this tank, and your leader, David, who you say is borderline fearless. Some might say borderline insane.
Yeah, yeah. It's a fine line.
Yeah, he went and got this little girl, and you saved her. And you, as you were moving out, you were shot in the leg.
Yeah, a bullet went through my right calf. It was, as far as gunshot wounds go, it was minimal. Went right through the leg. No, it didn't hit the bone, didn't hit any arteries, so... I was very lucky.
Yeah, so a Band-Aid and you're moving
on. Yeah, a Band-Aid was fine.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you say you have to know where you come from, and you were a Navy SEAL, and you were you had gone seen battle, and you went back for more training, et cetera, and you were kind of, you went into a really deep depression at that time. How come?
I did. I joined the military for very idealistic reasons. I wanted to serve my country. I wanted to help other people. And I wanted to do that as a soldier, sort of representing my country and representing good, if you will, on the battlefield and go to places where other people necessarily can't go. And so when I was in the military, you know, you specifically the SEAL teams, you have this 18-month workup that you do. You're just training, and then you do a 6-month deployment. Now, during that 6-month deployment, you may or may not, you know, be sent on actual combat operations and things that you signed up to do, right? And so I got to do that. I got to experience that. But then during my time, there was a lot of training, which you need to do that to be good, right? If you want to be a SEAL, you got to train hard. But it just wasn't quite enough for me, and I felt like I could do more. I felt like I wanted to every day wake up and go do something to help other people and not just train over and over
again. And so that's when you joined the Free Burma Rangers?
Yeah, about a year and a half ago, my time in the Navy ended, and I was in the Navy for about 6 years, 4 months. And then right after that, I went and I wanted to do humanitarian work sort of in a combat zone and that sort of thing. And the Free Burma Rangers were doing that. And it was, you know, volunteer thing. So I just showed up. And
so when you were there, you're not allowed to, you're not going in on missions to do assaults. You're there for humanitarian reasons. You're in to go get people. And if you have to provide cover or take people out, you know, to be able to provide that, you know, those people out. Yeah. But you're not an army.
No, not in the slightest. It's you know, it's strictly humanitarian, but you are operating in a war zone, and you have a few guys who are former military. David Eubank, he's former Army SF Ranger.
Can you talk about him for just a minute?
Yeah, absolutely.
He's a guy who I think is remarkable.
Absolutely.
I mean, he just goes to the worst place and takes his family.
Yeah. With the family, they try to keep them back. You know, obviously they're not
on the front line.
His 11-year-old son Peter's not out there, you know,
right,
with an AK. And that's certainly a little bit. That's certainly a little bit controversial. But seeing them and how they operate and what they do, I think it's a good thing. And they keep the family back, like I said.
Yeah, I don't want to concentrate on the family. I didn't mean that to be the controversial part. I just mean that he and his family are so dedicated. It's not we love war. I love the smell of napalm in the morning. They are deeply, profoundly Christian. They feel led by God to do these things.
Yes, absolutely. David is probably the most devout Christian I've ever met in my life. If you ever speak with him, he'll probably pray before you start talking, and he'll probably pray after you finish talking. He just loves to do that. His faith is what drives him and what drives his family to do what they do, and they love what they do. They're passionate about what they do. They've been doing this for 25 years, I believe, with the Free Burma Rangers. That was when it was started back in the 90s, and they're the real deal. It's not a short term, you know, sort of quick adrenaline fix. They do this, and they've been doing it for, you know, over two decades now, and it's their lifestyle. It's what they do.
So you just got back from Myanmar, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And I know very little about it. I know that there's the Karen people, right?
Yeah, Karen is used.
Karen,
how do you say it?
Yeah. And tell me about them.
So the Karen, they are a ethnic minority that's inside of Myanmar. So also one thing with Myanmar that other people don't know is Myanmar was originally called Burma. And the sort of illegitimate oppressive government changed the name from Burma to Myanmar, sort of their way of erasing history.
Okay.
Which, you know, there's obviously a commonality. Evil people tend to do that, right?
Yes.
and so they're trying to sort of erase that history by calling it Myanmar. So everybody tries to call it Burma. If you're calling it out, you know, you call it Burma.
Okay. And there's bad ethnic cleansing going on there.
Yeah, that's been going on. So it's a civil war that's been going on for about 69 years right now. So literally as soon
Holy cow.
Yeah, it's the world's longest running civil war. As soon as the British left in 1949, essentially the ethnic Burmese, who are the ethnic majority of the country, they were left in power because before the British had shown up, it had been a Burmese sort of monarchy for 1,000 years before that. Mm-hmm. So, but the ethnic minorities, specifically the Karen and the Kachin, on sort of that north eastern portion of Burma, they had had some sort of liberty. They had felt liberty under the British rule, and so they didn't want to give that up. They didn't want to sort of be second class citizens underneath these ethnic Burmans. So, long story short, the Burma army launched a campaign and it's been a full on war for 69 years to get rid of everyone else that is not ethnic Burmese or Buddhist. And it's one of those things where if these people decide to sort of bend the knee for example, the Karen, like if you can be a Karen person and live in Yangon around the Burma army, they don't care, but you have to understand that you're a second class citizen. You don't get the right to vote. You don't get the right to, you know, to move up in government or anything.
It's very much like ISIS. You just pay the tax.
And, exactly. Yeah, exactly. You pay the tax and like, we'll leave you alone.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
It's very, very similar to that.
So you don't think of Buddhists as, you know, people that are trying to commit genocide.
Yeah.
You just don't think of that.
Right. Right.
You
right.
always think of like you're peaceful Buddhist and, you know, you get along with everybody and, you know, rub the little fat belly and everything is great.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That's not the case here. Now, they're rounding up these Christians. Are they in camps or are they just... How are they doing the genocide of the Christians?
So the genocide, the way it works is it's instead of sort of an ISIS tactic, like, you know, ISIS, they do sort of a blitzkrieg, right? They go in and they just go and slaughter everybody. The Burma army attempts to do that as well, but you're dealing with the jungle. You're not dealing with the flat Nineveh plains. Yeah. It's very different tactically. So what they do is they go into villages and they attack the villages and kill everybody that they can. Men, women, kids, animals, everything. And they try to push these people out. And it's usually village by village, very, very small movements. And then as soon as the Burma army leaves that village, a lot of times what they'll do is they'll leave landmines in the village. So that way when the people try to come back, who've, you know, run into the jungle because they saw them coming, when they come back, now they're stepping on landmines and there's a bunch of other issues. And that's sort of the way that it's been working. Now, as of recently, so like last year, they hit the Rohingya in like a full, who are mostly Muslim, they hit them with a full-scale onslaught, sort of a full-scale attack, which they've done against the Karen back in the 90s, and it's looking like they're going to start doing again here very soon. They're also, they moved the same units that attacked the Rohingya and displaced about 1 million people. They moved those same exact military units up to the north of Burma to attack right now the Kachin, who are about 90% Christian, and then the Karen, they've already started moving troops down, and it looks like they're going to hit the Karen.
I don't think people understand that right now, Christian persecution around the world is at its apex. It has not been like this, I mean, really since the time of Christ.
Yeah, it is interesting. Well, you know, a very Christian thing is, you know, where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty, right? And people don't like liberty. They don't want you to have your liberty. Mm-hmm. And so you have to get rid of the idea that all men are created equal, right? Mm-hmm. You have to get rid of that idea that our founding fathers had. And you have to get rid of those Christian principles if you want to control, if you want to control people.
So now the Nazarene Fund, you're doing work with the Nazarene Fund.
Yes.
And you're bringing the Nazarene Fund to Burma.
I'm bringing the Nazarene Fund to Burma. And it's been absolutely incredible. I'd been doing some volunteer work in Burma for a few months at the beginning of the year. And then actually David Lopez, another SEAL, he heard about what I was doing. We've sort of been in contact on and off for about the last year and a half after the rescue video and stuff. Yeah, he's great.
He's like the most gentle bear ever.
Oh, yeah, he's a big teddy bear. I actually ran into him at the airport the other day. I was flying to New York City, and he was actually flying down here to Texas. We literally crossed paths at the airport. Mm. We had the same gate. They were right next to each other. Anyway, he got me in contact with the Nazarene Fund, and he said, hey, there's some guys I want you to meet. So I flew out to Salt Lake City and met the guys from OUR, met Tim mm-hmm. Ballard, met all those guys.
Yeah.
And then I got a call from Rudy. I call him Uncle Rudy. Yeah. Rudy Atala.
Yeah.
And he's like, hey, man, we want to get you on the payroll and continue expanding what you're doing already over there. And
so what are you going to do with the Nazarene Fund? What are you going to do for the Christians there?
Right. So sticking with the traditional role that the Nazarene Fund has been doing sort of in the Middle East with trying to rescue people, you can't quite do that in Burma. It's not quite the same mission. The mission there is definitely to save lives. So our big thing that we're trying to do is we're going to, and we're in the process of setting up a communications network, sort of an early warning net, if you will, so that way the people in these villages have a little bit more time to know when the Burma army is coming, and we're going to get them some basic equipment and things like that to sort of predict when these attacks are going to happen. Mm-hmm. That's one of the first things that we're going to do. So security is your first thing. Also, there are major humanitarian needs because the war has been so long. A lot of NGOs are kind of getting use the word bored, but they're getting
fatigued.
They're getting fatigued. Thank you. They're getting fatigued with it, and so over the last 2 years. A lot of support for the refugees and the people living on the Thai side of the border who have no place to go, support for them has been dwindling. So I was just at one of the refugee camps in Thailand, and right now in little neighborhoods of that massive 30,000 person Jeez. Refugee camp, which has been there for about 10 years or longer, I believe, they're already having to start sharing food, and they can't accept anybody, and they can't accept any more people. I talked to the guy who runs the camp, and he's like, we can't accept more people. Like, they can come here for safety, but somebody's gonna have to share food with them. Yeah.
So if you would like to get involved, please go to mercuryone.org and join us in our ever expanding quest to save religious minorities and Christians that are in danger. As I said, and this actually all really kind of came down to a rabbi telling me this. Glenn, stop talking about the Jews. You guys are first this time. We're behind you. You're first. And that is true. Please join us with the Nazarene Fund. You can find out more information and donate at mercuryone.org. Thank you so much for everything you do.
Absolutely. Happy to do it.
Sponsor this half hour is LifeLock. Public Wi-Fi at airports, great, but hackers can get into the networks, any kind of public Wi-Fi, and as you're transferring any kind of information, especially to a financial institution, they have you. That's why I want you to look into LifeLock. Lots of threats in today's connected world. That's why the new LifeLock Identity Theft Protection adds the power of Norton Security, which will help protect you against the threats to your identity and to your devices that you can't easily see or fix on your own. If you have a problem, they have agents that are going to work to fix it. Nobody can stop all cyber threats or prevent all identity theft or monitor all transactions at all businesses. But LifeLock with the new Norton Security can see threats that you're going to miss. So I want you to go to LifeLock.com right now and use the promo code Beck. You're going to save 10% off your first year. Plus, you're going to get a $25 Amazon gift card with annual enrollment. That's promo code Beck at LifeLock.com. 1-800-LifeLock. 1-800-LifeLock or LifeLock.com. Promo code Beck. Don't you feel like a slug after meeting people like that?
Yes. It's hard to imagine we're the same species.
He's 26 years old.
Yeah.
He doesn't look old enough to have the experiences that he does. I mean, and he got out of depression by serving people.
Yeah, and he's accomplished more than
we'll ever do.
It's interesting. There's a serviceman passed away the last couple of days, and he had been deployed to Iraq nine times, Iraq and Afghanistan nine times. And, you know, people were saying, like, how can we be a society that would allow someone to be deployed nine times? And we should always strive to not ever have to deploy anyone who doesn't want to go. But we have met so many people over the years that believe so strongly in the freedom of others that they will be deployed every day to the end of their lives if they have to.
And they regret it when they can't.
When they can't. They feel like, I should be out there with my guys. I know. And, you know, I think you see that here as
well. But your life has meaning.
Because he's not, I mean, he's not being deployed.
No, he's not.
He's just doing it.
He's doing it. This is, he didn't work for the Free Burma Army. He didn't work for them. It's all volunteer. The Nazarene Fund, he's going in by himself. He was just there in the jungles by himself, pulling Christians into safety, and went over to the refugee camp to find out what's going on. He's going to do this by himself, a Navy SEAL, and set this whole thing up. And I asked him, I said, so who's your team? And he said, I haven't selected them yet, but they'll all be people, you know, Christians from Burma. He said, because they... I want them to be able to stand on their own 2 feet in the end. We can't just keep paying for this and have Westerners coming over and helping them. They have to learn how to do it. That's phenomenal. Just phenomenal. Please get involved. Mercury1.org. That's Mercury1.org for the Nazarene Fund. It's amazing work. Be a part of it. So I thought we had... I thought we had a year to be able to do this, but I don't think we do. You know, I told you about Abraham Lincoln's, all of his clothing that he wore the night of the play that he was killed at, you know, his gloves, all of the personal items, his hat. Those were all held by a private individual from the 1800s all the way up until recently. Finally came to the open market, was sold to the Lincoln Library. They paid $23 billion for all of this stuff.
Three what?
Million.
Okay.
Okay.
Right. That's $23 billion.
No, $23 million.
That's a really
expensive
hat.
That's a price hat. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But this is, I mean, this tells the story. They're about to lose it. They have $10 million left on the payment. It's due next year, and they don't have it. They have $5 million. They think in matching funds from private individuals. They just have to raise $5 million. So we started 54Lincoln.com. And we ask you just to give $5, and you can get on a renewal thing. So it's, you know, once a month, $5 a month to be able to preserve this history. This will go to open market and most likely will not be seen again. It was held for 150 years in darkness. It'll go into a private collector's hands. And I like things being in private hands, but only if they're being shown. This most likely will disappear. And it's sad. So please help us save this Lincoln piece of history that is just awesome. They have to take it to the auction house, I think, by January, even though they're a year out from raising it. They need to have a significant dent made by January. So please go to 54Lincoln. And, you know, $5 a month or whatever you can do a month would be great. Help raise this cash to be able to save this important piece of history. Welcome, Pat Gray. How are you, sir?
Awesome. I'm perfect. You?
I mean, same. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just like, wow.
Yeah.
So, so Pat, mm-hmm. you're concerned today about...
We've been talking about this for a long time, at least 15, close to 20 years probably, mm-hmm. Embedding chips into people's foreheads or into their hand.
Definitely not Digital Angel.
Definitely not. The Mark of the Beast.
Mark of the Beast is not.
It's not. No.
No. And I mean, it sounds like it.
I mean, yes.
It's exactly what St. Paul described mm-hmm. in the cave.
But it's nothing. It's not. Because right. people love it. They right. love it.
Right.
They're not being forced into this. They're doing it willingly.
Right.
There's a company.
Well, in China, they're being forced.
In China,
into.
Yes. And, yes. Well, a little closer to home, like Wisconsin. They're, right. they're doing it there as well.
Right.
At a...
a surprise in Wisconsin, the progressive state.
A company called Three Square Market is, mm-hmm. Has 250 employees, and so far, 80 of them have voluntarily received the chip.
Now, okay.
It's super, super convenient.
Oh, it is.
It's super convenient.
Yeah, you can, all the doors unlock for you.
Right. You just swipe your hand over the scanner, door opens.
Yeah, you come to your computer and it automatically puts in your passcode and everything else. It's great.
You can go to the company's market and just swipe your hand and buy stuff. Comes directly out of your account.
Mm-hmm. It's fantastic.
It's great.
Really good.
I mean, everybody loves it. And I'm sure there's never going to be a time when that could go radically, radically wrong.
Like, what do you mean?
Well, all they're doing is storing all of your information and your medical information, your financial information, and, you know, just to have that implanted in your skin.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it's nothing could go wrong there. We all know that the government will always be benign.
All right, so here's the thing.
And never work with these companies to gain our information.
Right, right. Okay, so here's the thing. The only trouble I could see, besides this crazy talk that that's, you know, the beginnings mm-hmm. of the mark of the beast, is you could cut that out. So if somebody wanted to steal your information, you could cut it out. You need to have it. You need to find a way so it fuses with the body. So once you have the mark of the, once you have the chip,
right,
it can never be removed.
And digital agent, don't they have that?
I'm not sure.
Method? I think
I'm not sure.
We haven't talked about this for a while, but I remember that it ran off your body's biorhythm.
Mm.
You remember that?
Mm-hmm.
And they were concerned that somebody might extract it. And they said it wouldn't work because it becomes part of your body.
It's good.
So it wouldn't work for anybody else.
Huh.
So all they have to do to track you is put one of these inside of you. But you're not doing anything wrong. Why would you worry about it?
Well, that's what the Chinese are saying now.
Right.
I mean, the Chinese are getting it. And China is saying, you know, the Chinese people who, mm-hmm. by the way, lose social points. I don't know if you ever saw Black Mirror, but, you know, China is doing what the Black Mirror made, you know, light of, you know, in some ways, brought to kind of the...
Nothing that was light.
The twilight zone of this generation is Black Mirror. And it showed that, you know, you'll get social scores, and depending on who you talk to, how you treat others, if you break any laws, if you, you know, are pedestrian and you're not using the sidewalk, you lose points, and that depends on what you can access.
Look, it's a science fiction show.
Well, except
it's supposed to warn of some, you know, dark thing that could happen in the future.
Yeah, except it's happening.
It's not going to happen.
No, it's happening now in massive communities. The first trials started in 2016, and it'll be fully implemented by 2020 in China. And the people there, again, they lose points if they talk to foreign press and say something that's not good.
Mm-hmm.
But they're all talking to the foreign press, and they all love it.
They love it.
They love it.
They love it, too?
They love it.
They're not doing anything wrong. Why wouldn't they love it?
They say, now traffic is perfect. Nobody speeds. Nobody does anything.
Wow.
It's wonderful. Mm. They love it.
By the way, this is completely unrelated. I want to make sure you guys know it's completely unrelated. But, you know, sometimes we bring up unrelated stories in the middle of the broadcast. That's what we do. We're covering a lot of different topics.
Right.
Facebook has begun to assign its users a reputation score, predicting their trustworthiness on a scale from 0 to 1.
Wait, that's exactly the Chinese plan.
No, this isn't in China. This is.
Oh,
here.
This is okay. So oh, this totally is Facebook. Different. Okay, it's so here. It's in English.
It's
in America. It's totally different. Uh-huh. Then you're right.
Previously unreported rating system, which Facebook has developed over the past year, shows that the fight against the gaming of tech systems has evolved to include measuring the credibility of users to help identify malicious actors. I'm sure we're really...
None of these things are a problem at all.
None of that.
It's all going to make our life better. It's all going to make our life more convenient. It's all going to be easier. I mean, Sam...
All you have to do is comply.
One of their software engineers, Sam, says, I use it 10 to 15 times a day.
Oh, wow.
I love it.
If Sam likes it... I feel like that's enough.
Sam, I am.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Wasn't he the green eggs and ham guy?
Yeah, he won't try it with a box in a fox or something like that.
That's probably what happened here, right? Like, he wasn't going to try the digital implant, but then he decided to try it and he liked it.
His friend said... Sam, try it. Try it, I say.
Comrade, you're going to love
it. You like it.
So I think it'll be good. I think it's all, you know.
We've just become such sheep. It's just following
what?
Each other to the slaughter.
What are you talking about?
But it's so good.
It is so good.
I mean, it's the problem.
Really convenient.
I mean,
everybody loves convenience.
It is. I mean, all of these things. Glenn, we've done the show now for 20 years together. And Pat, you know, you were working with Glenn before that, and we've worked together for a really long time as well. And we've talked about these developments over the years long enough now to be on record saying things that we do every day were incredibly creepy. Like, you could go back and listen to those shows from 10, 15 years ago. We would say, look what they're developing. This is insane. No one will ever do this. And we're doing it right now. I mean, we're carrying around multiple GPS devices everywhere we go.
Yeah.
I mean, the things that we do, it happens so fast because it's so useful and so great.
And that part, the part that we're already doing it makes it easier to go ahead and implant it in your skin. Because you've already got trackers anyway. Yeah. You got a GPS system in your phone, in your car. Mm-hmm. They can find you anywhere. So don't worry about it. Just put this in as well. And then we'll find you when you're even not in your car or with your phone.
Wait until they start to. This is why. I don't know if we left this part in. Did we leave the part in the book? Stu, you've read it. Did we leave the part in the book where I talked about the merging of man and machine, where
there's definitely stuff in there about that. Yeah.
When we get to the point to where transhumanism, where they say, look, you got to upgrade your memory. Because if you don't upgrade your memory, you're not going to be able to stand a chance.
Can't
you
keep
behind.
Up.
You won't be. Yeah, you'll be left behind. Your kids will have no chance. There's nothing. Look at we're sending our
everybody
kids,
will
we're sending our kids to college right now, knowing it is the source of most of our problems, and we are paying colleges and universities to destroy our kids and our country. We're paying them. We're enslaving our children to massive debt when we know it's not worth it. We know that it's the ill effects and how they are coming out programmed differently, and we're doing it. You think we're not going to put chips?
I bet we will eventually.
Of course we will. We'll begin doing it within 10 years.
We did shows about the cashless society. How many times have we used that phrase? And it's been obviously, there are clear warnings about this. We talked about this yesterday. I've had $4 in my wallet for a month. The same $4 living in my wallet for 1 month. Not more than $4, just $4. I'm doing lots of stuff. I'm buying lots of stuff. Mm-hmm. But I have $4 in my wallet, and the same $4 constantly live there.
I have 20 folded in my wallet. Mm-hmm. That's it. And I've had it folded in my wallet for maybe 10 years. I mean, I don't even know the last time you used cash. You don't use cash. We're in a cashless society.
We basically are, right? And that stuff happens. You don't even, because it's so much easier. I don't want to get through change. What do I have to do with the change? These are not even serious concerns.
We always thought this was going to be forced on us, and it was going to be presented as if it were, you know, something sinister. Well, no, it's going to be presented as if it will change your life. It's going to help you. It's going to save your life. It'll save your kids. Because if anybody ever kidnaps them, if they have this little chip in them, we'll be able to find them wherever they are. Nobody can kidnap your kids.
But isn't that the way?
Be great.
Isn't that the way evil always wins?
Yeah.
I mean, look at this. You're going to college. Well, it's good. Your kids have to be educated. They're going to have all these great opportunities. Well, no, it's enslaving them to debt. A lot of research shows that this is really changing our kids fundamentally. It's their stated goal to change our kids and make them less like the parent. And we do it anyway. Look at all of the things that we do right now that we know are bad.
We talked about this a while ago, of the 1984 versus Brave New World. Which one are we going down the road of?
Both.
Maybe both, but Brave New World seems more likely to me.
Brave New World, I think, is... I think everybody is declaring Brave New World, and even I did. Brave New World is the winner. You know?
Yeah, I think it's more likely, but I don't know if it's the winner.
Dr. Huxtable was right.
No,
Isn't that who wrote it? Yeah, I think it was Dr. Huxley.
No, I don't think so. Clifford did that. He was more of a medical doctor.
Yeah, I don't think he used Clifford. But Brave New World is the way that we are headed. But there comes a point to where I think, and we're there. We are there. We're at this tipping point where people are like, I don't want to go forward with this because you guys are scaring me. You're seeing this with the Democratic Socialists and everything else. They don't want to go there, but they also don't want to necessarily go back. And so they don't know what to do. That's the point where the New World Order and 1984 come in. Brave New World can take you up to the precipice. And then I believe it takes somebody to strong arm an event. And if that doesn't work, they strong arm you into it and say, you're doing it. Because really, I've asked this over and over again, and we need to start asking people who are yelling at us, and we're talking and yelling at on Twitter. We need to ask ourselves and others. Let's say you get your way and you win all the elections. What's going to happen to the 50% of the country that doesn't agree with you? What are you going to do with them?
Well, the Weather Underground had that all figured out.
Yes.
They're going to do some re-education camps in the Southwest.
China is doing. So that's what China is doing.
Yep.
Thanks so much, Pat.
Over a million Muslims.
Yes.
In re-education camps in China.
Yeah. Is that a problem?
No. Not for me.
But America has the problem with Muslims, and we'll get continually beat up about how we're hateful. Pat Gray Unleashed coming up on the Blaze Radio and TV Networks. You can also get the podcast, and Pat also appears on The News and Why It Matters, one of the top podcasts in America. You can check that out on iTunes.
Hiring is a challenge. One place you can go where hiring is really simple, fast, and smart. It's a place where growing businesses connect to qualified candidates and also used by Fortune 100 companies. And that place is ZipRecruiter.com/back. ZipRecruiter will take the job that you're looking to fill and send it over to 100 of the web's leading job boards. That's what everybody can do. They don't stop there. They have matching technology. And so what it does is it looks at what your parameters are, what you're looking for, and then it scans thousands of resumes that are all over the internet. Then it goes and it finds those people and say, you know what? This job fits you. You should apply for this job. The application comes in and ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and then spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match. This is so effective, 80% of the people get somebody that is qualified within the first 24 hours. ZipRecruiter, highest rating hiring site in America. And try it for free right now, ZipRecruiter.com/back. That's ZipRecruiter.com/back, the smartest way to hire, ZipRecruiter.com/back.
Glenn Beck.
Stu, what is the problem? Global warming is caused by...
CO2.
And CO2 does what?
It it traps heat and warms the earth, of course.
What is your solution to global warming if it did exist, as they say?
I believe that the market and would develop and scientists would develop
new technologies,
and we would adapt where we could as well,
right?
And solve the problem cheaply over a longer period of time.
Sure, so tax won't work.
No, okay. Definitely not.
Headline. Scientists find a new way to make a mineral which can remove CO2 from the atmosphere.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
There's a development, right, that they didn't see coming that may solve the problem cheaply and easily without trillions of dollars in global taxes.
And the good added benefit is if it goes wrong, it'll just suffocate all the plant life.
Yeah, but so, other than that, do you see any problems?
I don't see any problem.
Who likes vegetables anyway?
Right. Trees. They get in the way of progress.
Glenn Beck. Mercury.